You may be seated. I invite you to turn to the passage from Peter as we look at Peter's understanding of living hope. And it's best to contrast that against perhaps one of the darkest pictures of human existence that I'm aware of. I'm assuming that many, if not most, if not all, are aware of the myth of Sisyphus. Sisyphus is a god that was condemned by the gods to ceaselessly roll a rock to the top of the hill, only to have it, once he'd reached his peak, roll right back down, fall back by its own weight. So he'd go up and down and up and down. And the gods had reasoned this, that to put Sisyphus through such an ordeal was the most dreadful punishment that anyone could endure because it was futile and hopeless labor. He was free to act, but in his actions he would never accomplish anything. He would never get anywhere. His acts would always be hopeless, and thus they reasoned that he will come to complete and utter despair. Now that story highlights how central and significant hope is to carry us in the present, because the future promise of something being accomplished or some good or some benefit always motivates us in the present. That's how we roll. It's the way humans act. Whether you're religious or not, we all hope for things so that the then of what we're hoping for impacts our now in the present. We work with a better attitude, knowing that in the then is a vacation. We study hard in school in hope of graduating. We practice an instrument in hope of becoming proficient. We exercise in hope of becoming healthy, fit, or trim. It's hope that drives us to act in the present, the promise of a better future. But what if there were no hope? That with all your exercise, you'd never get healthy or fit or trim. And in fact, you'd become increasingly more unhealthy. What if as much as you studied, you'd never ever graduate? Or as much as you practiced, you could never quite get proficient? Or as much as you worked, there was never a vocation on the horizon? That you just kept working and working, and even worse, never really accomplished anything? That's Sisyphus ordeal. That's why hope is one thing, but living hope, or the theological virtue of hope, where we speak of faith, hope, and love, takes on a different dimension because it's built on a then that is the sure and certain hope of the resurrection. It's built on a promise that God has made that is rested in and becomes so sure that it is a living hope that drives us in the darkest times. Now, it's important for us to have some measure of hope and for Christians to have that theological virtue of hope, particularly because of a significant problem we all face. Preachers know. If you want to keep people's attention, if you want to be perceived as relevant, then preach on fear and worry. Because no matter what, no matter how spiritual your congregation is, they all deal with fears and worries regularly. It's all the time. And the reason why we do is because we hope. We hope, and therefore we fear that perhaps the hope may not come true. It's very interesting to note that hope and anxiety or worry are siblings. They share the same horizon. Anxiety looks forward into a future, but what it sees is not good. It sees danger and a threat, and therefore it fears. Hope also looks into the future, but it sees deliverance and well-being, and that then becomes the source of joy. The reason why none of us are ever totally free of anxiety is because anxiety shares the same horizon as hope. They both involve looking into the future. And the reason we know anxiety is because we hope for things. And we worry that that hope might not be realized. We're anxious that that might not come to fruition. That's why we can only counter anxiety with hope in the end, because anxiety and hope forever remain siblings. And it's that lack of hope that really shapes the culture milieu of our time. If there were one word I could use to describe our culture right now, it would either be hopeless or fearful. And really, they're so connected, you can't take one from the other. Jürgen Moltmann, one of my favorite theologians, he spent some time in a Nazi concentration camp. He is still alive to this day, but he writes a lot about hope. His parents were in there as well. And he writes that we live in a culture plagued by anxiety, that vague, oppressive feeling about what is going to happen, which always expects the worst. And the gloom which does not believe oneself or other people capable of anything positive. Anxiety is the reason why so many people only see the future as a threat to the present. They no longer view it as a chance for something new. It is that ominous sense of gloom, that loss of confidence or hopelessness toward the future, which is constantly expecting the worst. And then he continues by saying, we are anxious about the future. Here's the problem, though. It's our very anxiety that's robbing us of the confidence we need to master the future's problems. Anxiety blurs our vision and judgment. We're paralyzed by anxiety. And like a rabbit paralyzed by a snake, our very fear is our doom. And anxiety, our minds and hearts already experience what we're afraid of. Now, if you take that hopelessness to its full fruition, if you allow anxiety to breed fear and allow that to bear offspring, the ultimate offspring of hopelessness, the child it gives birth to, is always despair. Despair. So that you have in despair the darkest possible vision of the future you can imagine. It is the most anxious understanding of the future. An understanding of the future where instead of seeing life and possibility in the future, you see that death is the final and ultimate power. It obliterates everything that has gone before. Instead of seeing justice in the future, you say, you know, the impersonal universe is blind to matters such as justice. So survival is really the only law. And even survival must succumb to death, which obliterates survival. And when you see it in its darkest things, you start to realize that no matter what I do, I'm like Sisyphus, pushing the rock up until another rock comes by, and until another rock comes by, until that final rock comes by and obliterates all. Well, of course, you can create small pockets of meaning for a few brief moments as you're Sisyphus, but those brief moments of meaning are merely an illusion to keep your sanity by refusing to really see the reality that there really is no hope. If there's no hope, all is lost. Nothing remains. Shakespeare's right that history is a tale told by a madman full of sound and fury signifying nothing. Jean-Paul Sartre is right in saying, humankind is a useless passion. Everything we do with all the passion we have, it leads to the rock falling back. So what do we do? How do we counter that? Whether it's just simply anxiety or fear or hopelessness or the full expression of despair. And there's a number of ways to combat that that people have devised in our culture. One is this: rage against the coming night. I always think that's the funniest phrase of all. Rage against the coming night. Go ahead, to no avail. The night still comes. Or you can learn to live with your despair and resign yourself to boredom. Live the perpetual teenage, whatever, whatever. Or you can dull your anxieties with passing pleasures and endless diversions and intoxication and inebriation. You could just dull yourself to these things so that you actually don't have to face them. Or probably the most popular way to fight despair is fight it with wishful thinking, mere optimism. And of course, that'll work for a while, but that loses its power when the rock keeps rolling down again and again, which is exemplified so well in Monty Python's The Life of Brian, if you've ever seen it. In the final scene, Brian's on a cross surrounded by other people on the cross, and Brian starts singing, always look at the bright side of life. Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. And you're meant to see how absurd that is. There is no bright side there. So his wishful thinking, his optimism is powerless in the face of what is before him. It's little more than wishful thinking, and it will eventually buckle before the grim reality of despair. There's two other options. One was put forward by Camus. If you've ever read Camus, he's a philosopher that actually wrote a book called The Myth of Sisyphus. And in Camus' book, as he analyzes Sisyphus' ordeal, he says, because he's an existentialist, and all that's real is what we see, there is no place for faith or hope. And since what Sisyphus must face is all he can really count on as being real, he must not go beyond his immediate experience and think of any solution. What Sisyphus has to do is this, and this is the final line in the myth of Sisyphus. This is Camus' solution to the ordeal of Sisyphus. The struggle itself toward the heights is enough to fill a man's heart. One must imagine Sisyphus happy. Talk about faith. One must imagine Sisyphus happy. So that if happiness is possible in the world in which we live, then Sisyphus has to be happy. Now you might say, that sounds crazy, until you realize we've kind of bought into that idea when we say it's not the destination, it's the journey. Doesn't matter if we end up going over the cliff at the end, it's only the journey that really matters. If you've ever read a series of books and it has a bad ending, you know how that sours the whole book. And you know that if you're doing your best to race to the end of a cliff, and that's the end, that the destination does matter. You might have gone in another direction. There might have been another possible path to go. But Camus has to decide that the best that we can offer Sisyphus is we say he has to be happy. This has to be the place where he knows joy. Otherwise, he's going to be in despair. So in the midst of despair, he must redefine his despair and his hopelessness as happiness. Now that might seem shocking or sobering, but may I suggest that that's actually brilliant unless resurrection's true. That's actually more honest than wishful thinking and optimism if resurrection is true. And that's what's so wonderful about our phrase there in verse 3, our first verse. By God's great mercy, He has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, so that the hope we've talked about so far, wishful thinking, blind fancy, whatever, saying he's happy, that all has to deny aspects of reality. The beautiful thing about the theological virtue of hope is hope looks straight at the evil and says, it's Friday, but Sunday's coming. Jurgen Moltmann writes, genuine hope is not blind optimism. It is hope with open eyes, which sees the suffering and yet continues to believe in the future. And that's why I think we love that video. In Jesus, we're given the vision of God's glorious future painted against the darkest backdrop possible, the backdrop of the torture of the cross, where the bad guys win and death reigns and the movie is over and it fades to black. But the story's not over because it's Friday. Sunday's coming and Jesus rises, unveiling a hope that does not exist apart from the resurrection. A hope when all hope is lost. A hope that has faced the darkest realities and is risen. And what we find is this becomes the hope that is meant to drive us in this life. That in Christ's resurrection, we discover that death is not the ultimate power. It does not obliterate all that came before it. That justice is ultimately executed by God. That the one unjustly commend is vindicated. So that justice has the final word in the end. And that life is not ultimately meaningless, but that God's creation has a telos, a goal, a purpose. A purpose which is summarized in phrases like, that God may be all in all. Or in beautiful poetry like, death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For the first things have passed away in the restored and redeemed new heavens and new earth. And you say, wow, that's hard to imagine. I find that easier to imagine than that, being happy. I find that easier to imagine because Christ is risen. And in fact, the problem isn't that I imagine a future that's glorious. The problem is I don't allow it to impact my present as a living hope enough so that I lose hope because other things eclipse the reality of the risen Christ presence in my life. You see, Peter wants his suffering church to know, verse 4, that there is an inheritance that is theirs, that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, that is preserved in the presence of God so that they can be born again to a living hope. It demands a new set of eyes, new birth. It demands a complete reorienting of one's vision of life and reality and the universe as we know it. And because of that, it is that hope that is meant to allow us to stand our ground against despair. Indeed, I'll go one step further. When we say living hope, what we're saying is not that we simply believe, oh yes, it's a theological statement of fact, Christ rose from the dead. It means that we live it, that we've embraced it, that that reality has touched us and transformed our vision of reality. So that Jurgen Moltmann says this, I love this, he says, stop looking at Christ's resurrection in the perspective of history and look at history in the perspective of the resurrection. What he wants to say is, you know, you can spend all the time you want trying to prove the resurrection happened, but it's a transcendent event that has to do with eternality, with the end. So instead of trying to prove it, and in the end, what if it's proved to you and you say, oh yeah, check mark, Christ rose from the dead. That doesn't necessarily change your life or give you living hope. There are many people, I'm sure, that believe, oh yeah, Christ rose from the dead, and it does not in any way possible impact their lives as such that they have a living hope. Moltmann wants to say, let's see all of history transformed by seeing it in perspective of resurrection, of where it all is leading, and where we are promised an inheritance. So we don't just believe in the resurrection, but we have new birth. We have new eyes, new sight, new life, so that our lives become a sign of joy. And I love that. Verse 6, in this you rejoice even though you suffer various trials because that living hope can look the trials dead in the eyes. And then verse 8 is beautiful. Although you've not seen him, you love him. Even though you did not see him, now you believe in him and rejoice with an indescribable and glorious joy. So that this hope looks forward to this promise that's imperishable and undefiled and secure, that sure and certain hope of resurrection. And lives life, even in the midst of trials and suffering and darkness, with joy. With the sense that it means something. It matters. Because he is risen. And he, Jesus, is our future. That theological virtue is the virtue I'd love for all of us to apprehend and live this Easter season and beyond. Not empty optimism, which refuses to see the bad and denies the bad parts of reality, or wishful thinking, which just hopes that things will be better even though there's no proof that they will. Neither optimism or wishful thinking can stand before the harsh realities of a broken world because they both only want to see what they want to see, and they have to cancel out all the darkness. Resurrection hope instead looks straight into the darkness. It looks into the future with eyes wide open, so only the living hope of resurrection can stand strong and courageous in the cancer ward, and in the nursing home, and in hospice, and at the cemetery, and on the battlefield. Only that hope offers a promise that goes beyond anything that is offered in all of its secular substitutes. Because it's willing to see the suffering and see God's promised future behind it. It's Friday, but Sunday's coming. It's Friday, the world's hopeless. You can't change anything. Look what happened to Jesus. Even he's not able to stop the injustice and the oppression. The future is certainly terrifying, and yet what the anxious and the cynics don't know, like our preacher, they don't know. It's Friday, but Sunday's coming. That's what we as a church are to know. It is Friday, Sunday's coming. We have a living hope, and it is that hope that is meant to carry us through the darkest possible areas of life that we might encounter. Would you pray with me?